Today is Tuesday morning, January 13th, at Congregation Anshei Torah. This is one of the last classes in our semester on Sefer Bereishit using the Milton curriculum. We're in Unit 9, which is Akedat Yitzhak, the Binding of Yitzhak. This is our second class on that. Last time we read the story and said some introductory words, and most of the class remember we talked about a comparison between Akedat Yitzhak on the one hand and Gerush Yishmael, the expulsion of Yishmael on the other hand. We tried to show that they're quite parallel. In a certain sense, it means that Avraham Avinu, undergoes two Akedot, two trials. One concerns his first son, and one concerns his second son. And we talked about the differences between those two. I tried to point out, not everyone in the room agreed with me, that the difference between them points out a certain very important aspect of the Akedah, which is the following. In the matter of Yishmael, in Girush Yishmael, the expulsion of Yishmael, the parallel of Avraham, the partial parallel, who of course is Hagar, is completely and absolutely, totally passive. She does what has to be done, and no more. And when the tough gets when the going gets tough, the tough don't get going, she simply becomes paralyzed. And we pointed out that in the case of Avraham, although the Akedah is certainly about obedience, it's certainly about sacrifice, it's certainly about what we call heteronomy, giving up the power of your will to a force beyond you. It's certainly about that. And it seems from the text that Avraham passes the test through his willingness to sacrifice, to give in, to recoil, to retreat, to surrender to God. That's all true. But at the same time, through the comparison to the story of Yishmael, we see that in subtle ways, Avraham maintains his independence, maintains his autonomy, maintains his initiative. And he doesn't become completely paralyzed in the face of the inscrutable word of God. So for me, at least, it seems that although the message of the story is about surrender, it tells us that even when you're asked to and you're supposed to surrender to God, that doesn't mean to completely give up your autonomy. There still is, at the moments that it's called for, a place for autonomy and initiative and understanding.
How does he maintain his autonomy when he sacrifices his...
Again, the main theme is the opposite of autonomy. The main theme is heteronomy. It's giving up to God. It's surrender. But in subtle ways, just to give you one example, I remember that you weren't here last week, but in subtle ways, we pointed out that when God says to Avraham, don't sacrifice your son, then it says that Avraham lifted up his eyes and saw the ram in the thicket and went and sacrificed it in place of his son. In the story of Hagar, it doesn't say that she opened her eyes and saw the well. It says God opened her eyes. And to me that teaches that even though Avram here is in a mode of surrender, a mode of sacrifice, a mode of giving in to everything God says, but the minute God says, don't sacrifice your son, Avram is still active and he initiates the sacrifice of the lamb. He doesn't wait for God, the ram, doesn't wait for God to tell him. That he hasn't given up. He hasn't been paralyzed. He did what he had to do. He surrendered at that moment. But he's still Avraham, who has a head in the shoulders, who has a free will, and who understands, again, without God telling him, that the proper thing to do at this point is to sacrifice the ram in place of his son. So, going on, I should say just beginning, the Akedah. The curriculum we have in front of us has put together an impressive array of sources, some of them very, very interesting, exciting, and provocative, many of them echoing themes that people in this room brought up last week. So just going to go through a small number of the sources and see what meaning and relevance we can tease out of them for understanding of the Akedah and for its relevance to Jewish life in the modern era. So, the first one is the commentary of the Ramban, Nachmanides, who lived in the 13th century, the end of the 13th century in Spain. And Nachmanides on page 149. a small, small part of his words on the Akedah are brought for us here. So we're going to read them slowly and then go over them. Ready? You know what? I'm sorry. Why don't we read the Akedah again? Just to remind ourselves. It's been a week. It's important to refresh us. Yes?
I was just going to point out the other thing that we said showed that he was proactive. Mm-hmm. Was that when he told his people that came with him, you know, we will be back. He didn't just say, I'll be back.
Yeah.
We will.
He had a certain plan. Although I said we could read that differently, we simply could read it as not wanting to arouse their alarm. Yes, that's true. Chapter 22 of Genesis. Let's just read it again to remind ourselves of the full power of the story. Sometime afterward, God put Abraham to the test. He said to him, Abraham, and he answered, Here I am. And he said, Take your son, your favored one, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the heights that I will point out to you. So early next morning, Avram saddled his ass and took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. He split the wood for the burnt offering, and he set out for the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Avram looked up and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his servants, You stay here with the ass. The boy and I will go up there. We'll worship, and we will return to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and put it on his son Isaac. He himself took the firestone and the knife, and the two walked off together. Then Isaac said to his father Abraham, Father! And he answered, Yes, my son. And he said, Here are the firestone and the wood, but where is the sheep for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will see to the sheep for his burnt offering, my son. And the two of them walked on together. They arrived at the place of which God had told him. Abram built an altar there, laid out the wood. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abram picked up the knife to slay his son. Then an angel of the Lord called him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham! And he answered, Here I am. And he said, Do not raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your favored one, from me. When Abram looked up, his eye fell upon a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abram went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering in place of his son. And Abram named that site Adonai Yireh, God will see, whence the present saying, On the mount of the Lord there is seeing, vision. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I swear, the Lord declares, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your favored one, I will bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands on the seashore. And your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your descendants because you have obeyed my command. Abraham then returned to his servants, and they departed together for Be'er Sheva. And Abraham stayed in Be'er Sheva.
When I taught this the other day, I went back and looked at the Hagar story as well in my class, and it really opened some light there, because if you remember, Abraham there, after Sarah said, get rid of him, he was disturbed. And God came to him and told him two things. One, the kid will be okay, but two, your other son is going to be the great nation. So I take that out of this, and maybe that's why he knew God was going to intervene, because God already told him the son was going to live, because a great nation would go through him. So he went through the act in this story, but knowing that the conclusion was going to be God would come at the end.
Yeah. So that could be.
Yeah.
It's echoed in one of the commentaries we'll see today, and I'd like to argue it out when we get to that commentary. Yeah.
So, Yeah, I would never thought of putting the two the other night in preparation for class the other day. We went back. In fact, we went back one more story to where Hager was drawn the first time, where God said, you know, the kid's going to be a wild kid.
Right, right.
So the three stories really tie together. Ice Cube is 1, 2, 3. Hager knew that the kid was going to be a bad kid.
Yeah,
and that ties in with the next story, throw him out, and then throws it to the next story with this. They do tie together.
Yeah, right. Avram had heard from God that his continuation is through Yitzhak, and now he's told, sacrifice him. So the Ramban is on page 149. The Ramban was a major leader, thinker, Talmudic commentator, and also wrote a commentary on the Torah. He made Aliyah to the land of Israel at the end of his life, and was central in trying to reconstitute the Jewish community in Jerusalem when he made Aliyah. By the way, when he made Aliyah, at the end of his life, he didn't even find a minyan of Jews in Jerusalem. That's how dwindled down the Jewish population in Jerusalem had become.
Was this always the Torah reading for Rosh Hashanah, or did that evolve over time?
It says, I don't know how far back it goes. At least it goes back to the 4th century. In at least 1,600 years. How much further before that? I don't know. Yeah. It's pretty ancient. So, here we have the Ramban. We'll read. Page 149. And God tested Abraham. That's a quote from the verse. Hashem nisa et Avraham, says the Ramban. What gives rise to the concept of the test is, in my opinion, the fact that a person's actions are completely in his control. Should he desire to, he will act, and should he not desire to, he will not act. It is thus called a test from the perspective of the one being tested. The one that tests, blessed be he, will command the test in order to convert the potential into the actual so that the individual can earn reward for good deeds and not just good thoughts. You should know that God only tests the righteous at a time when he knows that the righteous person will do his will. And in that case, God wants to allow him a chance to become even more righteous. So he orders him to perform some test. But God does not test the wicked that do not heed his word. Thus it is that all the tests that we read about in the Torah are for the benefit of the one being tested. I have a question. What's bothering the Ramban? What's the problem that causes him to speak? And it's a problem that all of us certainly feel and experience when we read the biblical text. What's bothering the Ramban? What's the problem he's trying to answer?
Why Abraham would sacrifice his son?
No.
Why God would sacrifice his son?
Why God asked him to?
Be more specific.
Why
does God feel the necessity to give him a test?
Now we're getting close. Right? But remember what I said in the past, the difference between a question and a difficulty. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. No.
So, thank you for being honest.
Right.
Remember, I said a question is when I say, I want more information. Or I don't understand something. I say, why is this so? What did you mean? What is it saying? But a difficulty is when I point out a tension or a contradiction between two points, two assumptions, two truths, two events. For example, a question is, why are you going outside with an umbrella? But a difficulty is, why are you going outside with an umbrella? Behold, it isn't raining. A contradiction between the weather I see and the behavior exhibiting. So the Ramban comes face to face here with a difficulty. He has a difficulty. He doesn't say that outright, but he hints to a certain difficulty, theological difficulty. So we almost said what it is.
Why is he testing a righteous man?
Okay, that's very close. But
he then says that everyone's actions are completely within their own control. Then he also says that God wouldn't test him if he didn't know that he was righteous.
Right.
So God knew what he was going to do. So was that really
within his control.
Oh, okay.
So why?
Listen, Diane almost said it. If God knows everything, then what sense does it make to test?
To teach the person who does it.
That's the answer. That's the Ramban's answer. Yeah. Say it again.
It's specific to him.
But I want us to put the question on the table. In other words, we assume usually, when we talk about a test is an ordeal or an exercise that a teacher or a coach or a parent gives to a student in order to determine what the student knows, what the student can do. A test is given in order to ascertain something that I don't know, to figure out what I don't know. But if God knows everything, then what sense does it make to test? What is the place of a test in the framework of a God who knows everything?
Well, that's a test on fact. There's also a moral test. And that's what this really was, a moral test.
But
facts don't apply, it's actions.
But God knows.
But wait, the same thing on the moral level, says Marsha.
Yeah.
If God knows how I'm going to behave, then how...
No, that's you're learning
this
from this.
Who's learning?
Abraham, or whoever has a moral test applied to them, is learning by doing what's expected of them by this higher authority.
But he's already done it.
Right.
If he passed the first test, why is he being tested a second time?
Well, you all agree this test is much more than any of the previous tests. This...
He's already banished one son.
This is different.
Why is
it different?
He lost the test in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Well, he didn't have to kill the
test.
I don't know if... here, Avram is being asked to go much, 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 much further than he's ever been asked to go to sacrifice his son. Then the answer is given in the Ramban, and when Robert said, because I'm going to go back a second, I really want to distinguish between the difficulty and the answer. Right? Just because the Ramban gives an answer doesn't mean there's no difficulty to begin with. Right? Let's know clearly that the Ramban feels bothered by a theological issue. Again, given that God is omniscient, knowing all, what sense does it make for him to test any human being? I just want to say parenthetically, I hope I don't scandalize anyone in the room, that the Torah never says that God is omniscient. The Torah never says that God knows everything. I could easily say that God is giving this test to Avram because God does not know how Avram will respond.
Our God can't know because he makes a lot of mistakes.
Okay, so I see that I didn't scandalize Robert, the opposite of the case he's going with me, right? If you take the simple meaning of the Torah, you can easily say that God is on a learning curve. And God is learning about humanity and learning about Abraham. But the Ramban is at a point in Jewish history, in the Middle Ages, when it's become an established fact, an established belief, an established assumption, that God is perfect in the sense, among other senses, that God is omniscient. God knows everything. And that's probably the assumption of most of us in this room. Except for you.
He read the story of Noah. And he admits there he made a mistake.
I think that you're right.
And Avram argues with God. Avram is taking the position of God, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You're going to destroy the good with the bad. How could you do that? So God's judgment is not always accurate, so he can't be all-knowing.
Well, unless you say there that God is testing Abraham, right?
I have another thing that troubles me.
Yes.
That God is always dealing with the righteous, a tzaddik. Who admits to being a tzaddik one? Who? Have you ever met a Jew that says, I am a good Jew?
Yes.
You have?
Remember my people who say that they're so righteous,
always
self-righteous?
They're sometimes not right, but
they think they are.
They think they are, yeah. I've not met such a person. I always meet people that always are trying to be better. They never do enough.
Hang on, nice circles.
So wait a second. I want to make sure I understand
God
what you're saying.
God only deals with tzaddikim.
You're saying that if God only deals with tzaddikim,
yeah,
then what about the relationship of God with the rest of us?
Right.
Us mere mortals. Us
he looks non, down with us?
Us non-tzaddikim. None.
I have a possible answer, but I want to wait 5 minutes.
Okay.
To the end of the Ramban. But if I don't say it, then challenge me.
Alrighty, alright.
So I'm going to go through the Ramban with you. So the Ramban has an issue, has a problem, what we called a difficulty. And as Rabbi already said, and others of you indicated, the answer is, according to the Ramban, that a test is not something that's administered in order to figure out the situation, the truth, not to figure out knowledge and not to figure out moral standing. Rather, a test, and we use the word in this modern sense also, is a challenge. It's a stealing. It's an ordeal whose purpose is to make you a better person, to help you actualize that which is there in potential. The Ramban says exactly that, but I just want to say that I myself many times find that when ancient texts talk in their vernacular, I have like a mental block, a wall. I'm not able to immediately connect to it because the language is so different. I have to translate into my vernacular, my language, so it penetrates to my soul and to my heart. The Ramban says, in the second paragraph, the one that tests, blessed be he, will command the test owner to convert the potential into the actual. So the individual can earn reward for good deeds and not just good thoughts. That's what he says. That language doesn't immediately speak to me, but let's figure out what he means. Let's translate it into English. Right? In English, he's saying that we have a lot of potential within us, in our minds, in our hearts, in our the way we've been brought up, how we've educated ourselves, how we've trained ourselves. But until we have stumbling blocks to overcome, until we actually live it out in the reality of this world, that we don't become what we are potentially to be. We need those challenges. And that's what the Ramban is saying. It's to make us a better person, to help us become better. Lefum tzara agra, we say in Aramaic, no pain, no gain. And on so many levels, it's so true. Those people who have suffered, those people who have adversity they've had to overcome, those people who've been the underdog, those are the people that you see how they've grown and how they become greater than life sometimes, greater than they were. Certainly they become something that those of us who don't have those same challenges haven't become. It's a rather paradoxical situation that to really live life to the essence, it has to be hard.
So like that, God doesn't give you anything you can't handle?
Well, that's another point. It's a separate point because of course, the challenge, if it's too hard, it breaks us. And although it's often said that God doesn't give us anything too hard to handle, I think we've all seen people who've been dished out things that were too hard to handle. Right? And they don't grow from those challenges. You know, I'll say it in very stark terms. Some people die from cancer. Other people grow from cancer. It's certainly not true that cancer is only here to help us grow. But given that cancer does kill and does maim and then ruin lives, but those people who are able to overcome it, and that's not everyone, in many cases turn out to have grown from it. My wife is a former cancer patient, and she would never wish on anyone what she went through, but she claims that she wouldn't have wanted to have been without it. You know, and I've heard many, many people say that, how it's just caused them to become something much, much greater than they could have been. So in a certain sense, the Ramban is telling us something very paradoxical. If you want a meaningful life, hope for adversity. And that suffering and pain and challenges are what you need in order to become what you could be, if they're not too great, if you're able to find the strength to build yourself from them.
Because you learn to appreciate what you have and the good and the health and all of that.
It's like, you know, kids, like trust fund kids who never have to work a day in their life have no appreciation for what it means to achieve something.
Yeah, except don't have...
Right. Money can be a problem.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That becomes too generic a statement. That's not true across the board. But it often...
Well,
does.
I mean, right. it's one of the... Mm-hmm. If you're handed everything on a silver platter, you have no... for what it means to achieve anything.
And, right, for certain.
Right. All
And not only no appreciation, but you haven't learned the skills to deal with poverty, haven't learned the skills of initiative, of resourcefulness. They might be there within you in potential, but they're only there in potential. Yeah, yeah, of course.
The impact they have on their family and their community spurs efforts for research, donations to the synagogue or whatever their philanthropy is. I mean, it has a very, it's like a drop in the pond. So all the research. Yeah.
Right, that's certainly true. There are so many...
Like a sacrificial lamb to get the ball rolling on all these other efforts.
You know... nuclear energy is one of the great potential sources for human improvement in our generation. But there probably would be no nuclear energy today if there wasn't World War II.
Yeah.
It's just because of the war and the desperate effort to find a way to defeat the forces of evil that all that energy was put into developing the nuclear bomb that eventually became a force to be harnessed for good.
The irony of
that. And that's the irony of life. That's the essence of life, the Ramban is saying. The Gemara says, the Talmud says the following, Ein Adam Omed al Divrei Torah, I'll translate, Ele im kein nichshal behem tchila. Translation, one doesn't understand the words of Torah unless you first stumble over them. If I am given a text of Torah or any other text, intellectually or a text of life, and it's easy for me, I understand it immediately, then in most cases I'll never truly have understood its deeper meaning. And I say that as a text, and I say that for every day in life. It's only when I don't understand it, when I struggle over it, when I have an understanding that turns out to be wrong, and I go back to it again, and go back to it again, and I cry over it, and I'm not sure, and I'm frustrated over it, and I break my head over it, and I go back to it again and again and again, then when I got it, I got it, and it's part of me, and I understand it, and I identify with it, it goes inside. It's true for a text, and it's true for life. The great Hasidic thinker of the 19th century, who I look on as one of my mentors, Rav Mordechai Liner of Izbich, wrote a book called The Me'a Shiloach. On the Torah portion, he writes that this Talmudic statement about learning text is really about life. It's really about life. And there's no growth, as we've said already, there's no growth really without challenges. And he takes this one step further. Now I'm expanding the Ramban to go one step further. He builds a whole theology of Judaism upon this. And he says the following, that the Ten Commandments begin with the statement, Anuchi Hashem Elokecha. Three Hebrew words. I am the Lord your God. I'll write that on the board. I am the Lord your God. Anuchi Hashem Elokecha. Anuchi Hashem Elokecha. I am the Lord your God. And he does a little play on words in order to bring home an extremely foundational point. He says that Anuchi, I. There's another Hebrew word for I. As some of us know, does anyone know the regular, normal Hebrew word for I? Ani. Ani. Here's the word Anochi. Here's the word Ani. What's the difference between them? The Chet. Oh, I'm sorry, the Chak. Right. That's the Chet.
Right.
Very similar, the Chak.
Right.
One letter. So he uses that difference of one letter to show a foundational theological point. That one letter that's added to the word Ani to make it Anuchi at the beginning of the Ten Commandments, the word God says I, here I am, that one Hebrew letter, the tough has a meaning. It's a prefix in many cases in Hebrew usage. The word chaf, the letter chaf, does anyone know what it means? That you probably don't know. It means approximately, like, as. That's what a chaf means, as a prefix to a word. Says the Me'a Shiloach, Rav Mordechai Liner, read this word, I am the Lord your God, as if it said, ki ani, like me, approximately me. Approximately, almost like. In other words, says the Me'a Shiloach, that God, the greatest moment of revelation, the Ten Commandments, Mount Sinai, the thunder and lightning, says the Me'a Shiloach, God did not reveal himself. It was only kid. It was a little bit. It was like. It was approximate. It was kind of. But it wasn't the real thing. And then he goes on to say, why didn't God reveal himself completely? Why didn't God give us all the truth, all the answers, give us everything we need to live a straightforward, meaningful life? Because when God gives you everything, you have nothing. Just like when your parent gives you everything, you have nothing. If you don't work for it, then it's not really yours. He says, paradoxically, were God to reveal himself completely and absolutely, human beings would be paralyzed. We'd have everything. It would be a world of light, of beauty. A world that's all light, with no darkness, is blinding. If you have everything, if everything is simple, everything is straightforward, all the answers are there, there's no doubts. You know God, you know the right thing to do, you have no moral quandaries, everything is clear. There would be a life without meaning, a life of complete paralysis. No challenges. Why should I? Everything is simple. And therefore God, in his great mercy, withholds himself and gives us not only his light, but a little bit of shadows. A lot of shadows. That chaf, it's not all God. There's a lot of non-God in the world. There's a lot of doubt, there's a lot of dilemmas, there's a lot of difficulties, a lot of pain and of suffering. Thank God! Thank God that we have the pain and the suffering and the doubt and the inconclusiveness in so many moral situations, says the Me'a Shiloach. And all that really, it comes forth from what the Ramban just told us. That challenges are here when we're able to deal with them, to build us, to create us on a higher level. Without those challenges, without those tests, we wouldn't be what we could be. And that's really powerful.
Well, that seems to be God's mission with the Jewish people throughout history. It's always challenging them.
There's always challenges.
It's never easy for them.
Right.
For us, or even today.
Yeah. And that certainly is part of what's made the Jewish people into what it is. It's never been easy to be a Jew. And that goes back to Abraham, right? Goes back to Abraham. It's not easy, and it's a terrible, terrible burden. Let's admit it, right? It's a difficult burden. And sometimes we are willing to throw in the towel and say it's just too much. But at other times we realize that it's these challenges that are making us into the people, both as individuals and as a collective, that we are.
Well, then, if you go by this, then God's doing this to the Jewish people to show us that we can do it, to teach us a lesson
for our own good.
For our own good.
That's what the Ramban is claiming.
Right.
And then to go back to what Gilda brought up, I didn't forget. The Me'a Shiloach claims that life is all about overcoming the challenges. In other words, it's all about the process and less about the conclusion. It's more about the means than about the end. But in different terms, life is a journey, and the purpose of the journey is the journey. It's the process of learning, of growing, of overcoming. Without those obstacles, we wouldn't have any process of life, which means we wouldn't have any life. How does that come back to what Gilda was saying? Because you said you don't meet too many, you don't meet any people who consider themselves tzaddikim, righteous. They all consider themselves as just trying. What I'm saying is, if you're trying, that's what it means to be a righteous person. The process of making the effort, of putting in the time and the resources and the thought of what is the right thing to do, even if we don't always make the right decisions. But to be on the process, that's what makes a righteous person. When the Ramban says that God doesn't test those who are wicked, the wicked are not those people who fail. They're people who never try. Would claim the Mashiach.
It's very generous. It makes me feel good. It does. It really does. It makes me think I have potential. That's what it makes me think.
We all have potential as long as we believe we do. As long as we put ourselves in the process and don't just opt out of it. Yeah. Would anyone like to add further on this very big subject? Yeah. Okay, so that's the Akedah as a paradigm for our lives. That we have these Akedot that we are being challenged with all the time. And hopefully they're not too much for us and we're able to grow and become something greater through them. That's the Ramban. Let's go on to a second source. And I want to skip now to source number 3 in the booklet. We'll go back to 2. I want to skip to source number 3. Which is something that I believe that is terribly powerful, extremely powerful. And this was written by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik passed away about 20 years ago, if I remember correctly. Perhaps it's 22 years ago. He's the rabbi that ordained the most rabbis in his life in Jewish history. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, the rabbinic head of Yeshiva University. He inherited that position from his father before him, and his grandfather was one of the major Talmudic luminaries of Europe in the 19th century. In other words, this is a long, long chain of tradition, and his great-grandfather was also one of them. His great-grandfather was the Beit HaLevi, and his grandfather was Rav Chaim, and his father was Rav Moshe, and this is Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and I merited to study with Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law, Rav Lichtenstein, and now Rav Soloveitchik's grandson is Rosh Hashiva in Israel. It's a tradition of 6 generations that's very, very powerful. So Rav Soloveitchik writes the following. Offer your sacrifice. That is the main command given to the person of religion. Is the essence of religion is sacrifice, giving up that which is precious to you. The Holy One, blessed be He, says to Abraham, take your son, your only son. Right, our translation was your favorite son, but it's the same Hebrew word, only son, favorite son, Isaac. In other words, I demand of you the supreme sacrifice. Don't fool yourself that after you heed my voice, I will give you another son in place of Isaac. No. Likewise, don't think you will be able to forget Isaac and get him out of your mind. You will think about him every day. I want your son whom you loved and whom you will love forever. In your sleep you will cry out to Isaac, and when you wake up you will find your tent empty and abandoned. Your life will turn into a long chain of suffering of your soul. All of this notwithstanding, I demand the sacrifice. Not trying to sugarcoat it, not trying to say it's for your own good, not trying to say it's for your benefit, it'll challenge you, it'll steal you, it'll improve you, like the Ramban said. Just sacrifice is the essence of what God wants from man, the essence of what religion is trying to teach us, claims Rav Soloveitchik is sacrifice, to be able to give up what is most dear to you. That's all it is. And you know, in Jewish tradition, that's the way the Akedah has always been understood. It's just an example of, a paradigm of self-sacrifice. All those times in Jewish history, we've mentioned earlier, it's never been easy to be a Jew. All the times in Jewish history, and there have been thousands of them, when Jews have been called on to sacrifice their lives, sacrifice their family, sacrifice what they believe in, sacrifice what's dear to them, sacrifice their financial well-being, we always look to the Akedah and say, it's already been in the cards. Here's an example. We're following the footsteps of Abraham, who was simply called on to sacrifice. We don't know why, we don't understand why, but that's what God wants. And we're just doing it, and it's not easy, because we would sometimes want to opt out and take an easier way and pursue what's good for us and what's comfortable. But God wants sacrifice.
Somehow it's not in line with my personal feeling of God and what God is.
Thank you for saying that.
It's very contrary.
Because most of us in the modern world probably don't identify with this. Mm-hmm. Jews identified it with thousands of years, but we don't. We don't, to a large degree. So I want to make an effort.
When somebody has some kind of a sacrifice, let's put it that way, a lot of times they deny God because they're so angry. And so I don't know how this could help someone like that.
Yeah. I think that what you're saying fits in with what Linda said. In our mindset, it seems just immoral or wrong to be called on to sacrifice.
Because we can't come to grips with such a sacrifice like that.
It's just too much.
Why would God be cruel? Because we don't believe God is cruel.
It's cruel. It doesn't give anything.
God is a loving God, right. Forgiving God.
Yeah,
God
if life is precious and life is good, and we're supposed to create and mold and build and give and just cut it down, cut it off for no reason. Why?
Why does God want sacrifice? Real sacrifice. Not sacrifices that he doesn't go through with. But, real sacrifice.
Because in most cases in Jewish history, God has gone through with the sacrifice. Right? We've had to sacrifice our lives in the Holocaust, in the First Crusade, in the Second Crusade, in the pogroms in Spain in the 14th century, again.
But every human, and God doesn't just pick on the Jews. Every human faces that, no matter what philosophy, whether they believe in him or not, they have to sacrifice, no matter what. It's just, you say, well, it's part of being human.
It almost
is a sacrifice, as you said, for being human.
But different religions look at death in different ways. it's not as much a not that it's not a sacrifice, but, other religions believe that you will see those people again. So to them, it's not really a sacrifice,
Messiah?
Say it again, don't we what?
Believe that we will see our everyone again who has died because when the Messiah comes.
Yes, but it never becomes a focus so that it drowns out or blurs the idea that death is bad.
It's not like Christianity, but where they think they're gone to a better place and that you will, in the years to come, be reunited with your loved ones. It's interesting because I just had this conversation because a friend of mine's father passed away, and Christian people think, well, it's sad, but it's okay because you're going to see
they're in a better place.
They're in a better place, and we will be reunited. That's not how we think. You know what I mean? That's not how we think. And Muslims, they think it's better in that world than it is in this world. We believe that this world is a better place, so why would God ask us to sacrifice? That's what you're saying. They don't have to sacrifice like we said. It's not the same mentally as it is for us.
We're just talking about good and bad. But the person who said to me that this person's in a better place is Jewish. Because it's the only thing at that time during his utmost grief that made sense to him.
I can see where you say they're not suffering anymore.
I don't think of it in terms of a better place or a worse place. It is the inevitable for all of us, and somehow death has become this negative, this horrible, this thing that we fear, that we, I just don't view it that way. I view it as the ultimate that's going to happen to each of us, hopefully when we're very old, and we haven't suffered and all, but it bothers me that the death is given this horrible negative connotation. I don't have the issue with it somehow.
But then why is it a sacrifice?
We ignore it.
Then why would Abraham be sacrificed? Why would Abraham...
Because it's a young person who is still very much alive and has much to experience
and to give. But young people die all the time.
Well, that's when it's a tragedy.
But let's distinguish between two matters. One is death in and of itself, and what follows it. The other is the end of life. Death in Judaism is bad and evil and terrible because it's the end of life. But it's because life is good, because life is holy, because life is a potential to build, to mold, to create, to improve. Therefore, death is bad, not because of any bad things that would happen after your death, necessarily, but that might be also, but because it's the end of life.
But there's degrees of bad depending on whether it's a real old person or a real young person.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But even the life of an 85-year-old person has more potential creativity in it, and death is bad.
But if I were to find out today that I had a type of cancer that was definitely going to kill me.
God forbid.
Goes back to what Marcia's going to say. If I was Christian, I'd think, oh, okay. You know, good things are going to happen when I die. But because of what I believe death is, which I don't know what it is, it would be very scary.
Yeah. And Jews in general are afraid of death. Because it's the end of life. Because it's the end of the potential to keep giving and keep living and keep creating.
When I look at it, I look at it because it's that the fear of the unknown.
That's
what's to come. Or what happens to you, or, you know.
It's just cessation. Don't fear death the way Jews fear death. They may not be creating in this world anymore, but that's not their focus. Their focus is... Mm-hmm. I'm going to be with, you know,
right.
Jesus,
yep.
And life is going to be clouds and candy. You know, I mean, it's all going to be good. People,
it's sugar-coated.
It's all sugar.
Yeah, and certainly we have two different approaches here.
Unless you're bad, you go to hell. But as long as you believe in Jesus.
But yeah,
it's always that simplistic.
No, I'm actually conditioned on
that. No, but that's a general thing. They don't fear it like we fear.
You have to be a very, very good person. You have to...
In Christianity, all you have to do is take Jesus into your heart.
That's one part of Christianity. Yeah, that's what's different.
Well, okay, so...
Okay, wait a second. Generally. We're getting off topic a little bit.
Right.
I want to bring it back to sacrifice. Right?
But that's, you know,
going back to sacrifice. Ready? 33 seconds to get back to the Akedah. We had on the table the question... as follows, if Rabbi Soloveitchik writes and believes that sacrifice, the willingness to give up that which is much precious, is of the essence of religion, we said that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to our modern sensibilities, we have to ask why he writes what he writes. And I want to take some time, to explain his position. This is actually one of the major themes in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings. I want to mention an article that he wrote that will shed light on what we are learning. And the truth is, if I didn't mention this article, I could mention 10 other places he writes about the same theme. He wrote an article called Majesty and Humility. I'm going to put those two words on the board. Majesty and Humility. And the whole article is about the dialectic between majesty and humility. Dialectic means the tension. Rabbi Soloveitchik goes back to something we discussed 13 weeks ago, the first chapter of Genesis. The first chapter of Genesis, as we all remember, describes man who is at the pinnacle of creation. Man is here to subdue the earth, to conquer it, to be fruitful and multiply. It's an earth, according to the story in the first chapter of Genesis, an earth that makes sense, a universe that's orderly. God is a creator, and man is called upon to be in God's image, to be a creator like God. Man is supposed to be that miniature God, to create, to mold, to build, to improve, tikkun olam, to rectify the world, to improve the world, to continue on where God left off. Man, according to Rav Soloveitchik, if we look at the first chapter of Genesis, man is meant to be a majestic being, a great being, a powerful being, being like God. An autonomous being, an independent being, an understanding being, a scientific, technological, building, scheming, working, creating man. And that's good, and that's a divine value. Man could and should feel good about himself as he goes to create and build. However, as good as that is, as divine as it is, it's dangerous. We all know that there's a danger when people become too majestic, too full of themselves, too conceited, too haughty. It could be our own downfall. We forget our true place. We think that we're not just a partner with God, we think we are God. And writes Rav Soloveitchik that man was created to be and is supposed to be majestic, but that majesty has to be tempered by, balanced by humility. There has to be a certain willingness to stop, to set boundaries to our creativity, boundaries to our independence, boundaries to our molding and building and imposing our will on the raw materials of this universe. There has to be humility. There has to be boundaries. And says Rav Soloveitchik, religion comes to teach these dual values, that man is to be majestic in creating, but man also has to limit himself. If you don't limit yourself, then your majesty will never be holy. It will never be sanctified. It has to be purified by humility, by boundaries. How does religion teach us boundaries? You all guessed it. Through teaching us to sacrifice that which is most important to us. If I never learn to sacrifice, then I never really learn what it means to be human. I think that anyone who's a parent, and especially females, can identify with this. You grow through the framework that forces you to put your own interests on the back burner. You sacrifice so many of your dreams and wishes, so much of your time and energy for your children. And that makes you, in a certain sense, into a real human being. It doesn't mean you should only sacrifice and only do for your children and only give in. Sometimes you have to do it for yourself. But the doing for yourself, when you do for yourself, when you push forward, when you have that forward momentum, when you have your own ideas and you carry them out, and you build something, create something, whether it's a business, whether it's a scientific creation, whether it's simply an intellectual creation, whatever it is, when you do that, and you also have in your spiritual baggage the ability to surrender, then it's really, really meaningful. Right? When you're writing your doctorate, and you're willing to stop in the middle of a sentence because your child is crying, that what makes you human. That the majesty is tempered by the humility, by the willingness to recoil and retreat in the face of some other force that says, you are not the measure of all things. It's not just you. And claims Rav Soloveitchik that here is the essence of religion. And that's the Akedah. The Akedah teaches us to be like Abraham, that to be willing to sacrifice our most beloved possessions. Avraham of Sodom v'Amorah and Avraham of the Akedah, they make the whole Avraham. There's the Avraham that argues against God. That's the strong Avraham, the majestic Avraham, the powerful Avraham, the independent Avraham, the creating Avraham, the one who thinks for himself. And that has to be. You can't erase that from Avraham's personality. But that Avraham, if he's not balanced by the Avraham of the Akedah, who's willing sometimes to just stop in the face of the commands of the inscrutable God and say, I do what I'm told, I surrender, I give in, I sacrifice my dreams and my desires and my knowledge, That's what makes the full Avraham, and that is what makes the full human being, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's all about the balance. It's all about the balance. And perhaps in that context, we can better understand the centrality of sacrifice, willingness to sacrifice.
Like the Holocaust.
Right, exactly.
In our history, like the Holocaust.
Yeah.
I guess.
Is there somebody here who can answer some of that? Because this was working real well for me, and then you said willingness, and I'm going, well, there's situations where you have no choice for what happens.
Well, sacrifice, in the fashion we're talking about it, will have the desired effect, according to Rav Soloveitchik, only if you deal with it properly. In other words, you can be forced to sacrifice and be bitter about it your whole life. Mm-hmm. And then it hasn't had the proper effect. But if it's absorbed into your consciousness as a learning moment, that here I learn there are limits and boundaries to my power, to my understanding. If I'm able to absorb it into my consciousness, then it can have the effect of, like we said, purifying my very being. Purifying me by teaching me that I'm not the measure of all things. Of course, it shouldn't prevent me from trying to go on and continue to build, to mold, to create. But at the same time, knowing the boundaries involved with it. Let me give you an example that Rabbi Soloveitchik gives. Rabbi Soloveitchik interprets almost all of the halakha in the framework of this dialectic. Everything is about teaching a certain value and then teaching the limitation on that value. 6 days of the week and Shabbat. 6 days of the week you're supposed to mold, build, create, fashion. And that's good. That's commanded. That's a divine value. You're supposed to change the world, right? L'taken olam ha-malchut shaday, to remedy the world under the framework of God's sovereignty. That's good. You're supposed to work. Whether you're a doctor, or whether you're a lawyer, or administrator, or a politician, whatever it is, you're giving to the world, and you're giving long, long hours, and you're feeling good about making your impression in the world. That's good. But one day a week you stop. And you're working in the office until 4:30 at night, and you have a very, very important project to finish in just 1 hour, and I'll finish it, and I'll change the world. Stop. Stop. Just sacrifice what you're doing, and just give the next 24 hours to God. Does that mean that Judaism's value is just to rest and not do anything for your whole life? No. Is Judaism's value just to work and work and work your whole life? No, it's both at the same time. And they have to balance each other. 6 days a week of work, 1 day a week of rest, whether you're ready to rest or not, in a certain sense, Shabbat is a sacrifice. You sacrifice that time for God. And that is supposed to make the other 6 days of the week more meaningful, because you're giving and you're creating, but you know that there's a limit, and you're not the master of all things. That's an example. So of course, if you're bitter about the sacrifice, it doesn't have the proper psychological effect. But it's supposed to be absorbed to the consciousness and mold how you understand yourself as a human being. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's theory.
Making lemonade out of lemons.
It's funny that you used the
turning a bad situation into a
struggle. You're about to add?
I'm somehow just not comfortable with that approach to God and that approach to religion. I just don't view it that way.
But look at the Israelis, you know, that are being bombed, you know, the shells and all, you know, they've got this terrible sacrifice or potential for sacrifice all the time. And they still struggle. They keep that struggle up. You know, a lot of people in those situations. you know, and a lot of the Holocaust victims, you know, still struggled, no matter what. And they also kept their faith. Bob and I watched something very interesting, and it must be a play, but I never heard of it. It was called God on Trial. It was on PBS.
Yes, it's been on before.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
And it takes place in the one of the barracks of the concentration camp. And part of the, half of the men have been chosen to go to the ovens, and half haven't. They thought they knew who it was. But anyway, a new group of very religious people are shoved into there because it was a mistake with the trains and all this. And they actually got on trial. And I don't think they ever had an answer, but all the questions that come up are very interesting. And people are angry, other people say, you can't say that about God, right? It's just all the questions that everybody answers in their life, in their life, if they're, you know, God-fearing or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to answer here. And in the end, I don't think there was an answer or a verdict.
There is no answer.
There isn't.
It's just very troubling. There is no answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I don't know. Oh no! We're finished.
We continue this discussion at lunch.
No.
Who's going to lunch?
I hope we all are.
So we need a table for how many?
About 13, is it? So, does anyone not know where Natalie's is?
Hillcrest Campbell.
And Campbell, right. Okay.
Hillcrest
is Ohio.
Right, yeah.
On the southeast corner. Just going to say, Madison Humility, just practical. It just reminds me that in Israel, the higher up in the government, they live in regular homes and apartments, like everybody else. And you know, here in the U.S., we treat our people, the top people there, and you know how they live, and they have, you know how they treat it with the limos and all, and you all ever get to Jerusalem, and they'll be a tour bus, and they'll go, oh, that's the apartment building where so-and-so lives, and you might see something a little bit cordoned off, just a little bit, but other than that, it's business as usual, traffic going on, people coming in and out, maybe see one guard, it's funny.
Okay.
Always, always do that.